welcome listeners to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, your host for this program, and we're really excited that you took some time in your day to join us for this segment of the program. And we have some very interesting authors here. You know, we have Don McCown and Mark McCosey. I hope I didn't botch their names, but they are co-authors of New World Mindfulness, From the Founding Fathers Emerson and Thoreau to Your Personal Practice. And Donald McCown is Assistant Professor of Integrated Health at Westchester University of Pennsylvania and the former Director of Mindfulness at Work Program in the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine. And Dr. McCosey is Adjunct Professor of Physiology and Biophysics at Georgetown University School of Medicine and the Founding Director of the Policy Institute for Integrative Medicine in Washington, D.C., and also the editor of Fundamentals of Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So, you know, we're very busy people. We all long for quiet and connection. And despite the growing body of evidence supporting the benefits of mindfulness, our hectic pace of modern life leaves little time to devote to meditation, relaxation, and contemplation. And in today's show, we're going to talk about this and how we can bring this into our life easily. Gentlemen, are you there?
Hello.
Hey. Hi. Don McCown here.
Mark McCosey.
Thanks, and welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about how you got into this topic, how you got into using mindfulness in your practice and in your work. Why don't you each of you take a turn?
Don?
Okay, sure. Okay, well, let me start. So I've actually been involved in sort of the contemplative disciplines since my teens, so that's about 40 years worth of trying to tune in and be what I am and see the world kind of without too many filters. And when you see it that way, it's really quite a place, quite beautiful. And there's an aesthetic side to it that that I think the gentleman in the subtitle here of the book found as well. You know, the Emerson and Thoreau particularly finding the world to be a magical place, and one that's not too far, actually, just a mind state away from the franticness that we sometimes live in. So I had 30 years in the frantic world of business, actually in the advertising business, as a creative director and as a copywriter. And in doing that work, I really spent a lot of time helping myself and helping other people deal with their frantic pace and their anxiety over deadlines and that kind of thing. So actually, sort of the structured work with mindfulness comes out of that, a direct need in the real world, in the workplace, to be able to find center, to be able to find a little spot of calm, to see things clearly, and to be able to work with it. So I moved from that actually into clinical work, and I'm a social worker by trade and a psychotherapist. So that sort of brought me to working with people whose franticness and stress is very high level and is actually damaging them. And so I've seen sort of the benefits in kind of the business world, the real world, and the benefits to people who are suffering deeply of that contemplative place, that contemplative space. So I think that's what I need to say for now.
Thanks.
Well, I met Don 10 years ago when I went to run the Center for Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, which is one of the first half a dozen integrative medicine centers in the country. And I was very impressed with Don's work together with Diane Reibel, who I'd known before. And as a physician and someone who has tried to create a lot of educational tools for the health professions, like my textbook you mentioned, Fundamentals of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, we're going into the fifth edition this summer for that book. But I wanted to make Don's knowledge and his approach, you know, available to a wider community and help Don get his message out there, you know, to the world of health and medical education initially. And so we embarked on this effort to write a book first for the teaching professions called Teaching Mindfulness. And that did quite well. And then we wanted to sort of take that same information and make it available to the general reader, which is New World Mindfulness. And one of the reasons for that title is that we find that we don't have to look into exotic places or actually get into exotic environments or exotic postures to enter a meditative state. Oftentimes we think, well, you know, you have to go enter a Buddhist monastery, and which of course is one route to this type of enlightenment. But what we point out is basically mindfulness meditation can be part of every moment of every day. And it's easily compatible with our busy, you know, life. We don't have to enter the monastery, if you will. In practice, we can just sort of go there in our thinking. And we also point out a long tradition of what they called back in early American history, contemplation or contemplative thought. When you really look at what people like, you know, President John Adams or Thomas Jefferson, and on to Emerson and Thoreau and people that came after, what they were really advising is essentially what we would call mindfulness meditation today.
Well, let's talk about that, because the first part of your book kind of is a historical account. And, you know, I also am a professor of history. I teach medical history at University of Bridgeport, and I found it very interesting that mindfulness that our founding fathers or whatnot and other transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau were well read in the Eastern philosophy, and right from the start they were interested in this type of thing and put it into practice. Can you take us through this first part of your book?
Yeah. Let me talk a little bit about just sort of how far back sort of the contact with Eastern forms of thinking, Asian forms of thinking goes. So, you know, we can go back really to the 17th century in America, to the great Puritan preacher, Cotton Mather. So there he is. He graduates from Harvard College with his master's in divinity in somewhere around 1680. And he is in contact with folks sort of around the world, trying to learn for himself what it is that people do in spiritual practice, you know, in sort of greater India and greater China kind of areas. So he's corresponding, finding out how people are thinking, what people are thinking, getting bits and pieces of scripture and of descriptions of these contemplative practices. So, of course, he's thinking of it in his own terms and in terms of evangelization for, you know, his particular religion. But it's not too long after that sort of the big embrace of sort of a pluralistic look at the world starts to happen that I think is really a big part of American thinking overall. So a woman named Hannah Adams, who's a cousin of John Adams, you know, our second president, first woman to in America to earn a living as a writer, single woman. Her bestseller that went through many editions was The Dictionary of All Religions. And so she comes out of this sort of New England divine tradition in which she is willing to allow the other faiths, the other religions, to speak for themselves. And she says this very clearly right in the front of the book, that, you know, I am a confessing Christian, she says, but I want you, the reader, to be able to encounter these other faiths the way they are presented themselves. So I want to take myself out of the way, not comment, and let you see them. And by the end of sort of the development of this book over its many editions, she is describing Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and particularly the Sufi forms. So sort of 1744, I think, was the first edition of that, somewhere around there. So this is really, you know, sort of the backbone of America being built right there, the sense of religious pluralism and the sense of the value of all these other ways of looking. So the fact that this book went through so many editions and was so popular and, you know, allowed her to live a life of freedom as a single woman is really a testament to how people thought. And so, you know, you move another few years, and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams both were subscribers to the Journal of the Asiatic Society of Bengal, the British journal in which the great linguists and great sort of legal thinkers who had been sent to Greater India to govern, you know, so the colonial piece comes in here. But there they are. How do these countries work? How do they think? What's going on? Let's figure it out. Let's translate the big scriptures, the big books for them. So right at this time, right as our country's being founded, our founding fathers are interested in how other people are thinking, and how they're thinking morally and ethically, religiously. So both of those gentlemen, you know, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, read the Bhagavad Gita in translation. So Mark actually said this at one point to me. He said, so think about it. You know, John Adams, first resident of the White House, there in the White House Library at its founding was, you know, were the holy scriptures of Hinduism.
So, and Thomas Jefferson's library became the founding collection for the Library of Congress. And so that was in there from the beginning for the, not only in the White House, but the Congress as well.
Congress as well, yeah. So it's really kind of amazing and intriguing to think about the foundation of things that way. So
and then like when, of course, in the 70s when Nixon kind of opened up relations with China. You actually mentioned in the 1850s the opening of Japan to the U.S. with Commodore Perry's visit.
Right.
May have also added to this infusion of Asia into our
hugely, yeah, a really big impact. I think culturally, aesthetically, even.
And it went both ways, actually.
Like. Yeah.
Because when the Chinese, and with the opening of the door, a lot of the Chinese workers, you know, came to the U.S., of course, to build the railroad and a lot of other things. And they discovered the American form of ginseng.
Yes.
Which
right.
is even more potent. And so, you know, the American ginseng, which came from the Appalachian Mountains, you know, made its way back into China as part of that exchange. So it goes both ways.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Really amazing. So we're just sitting here in the middle of the 19th century now, talking. So we have Emerson and Thoreau and Bronson Alcott and all these folks who are at some point steeping themselves in the works of Greater India, and actually an awful lot of interest in Sufi literature at the time. Lots and lots of translations of Sufi poems happening at the same time. So a real sort of American mix of things happening. And what's intriguing to me is that both Emerson and Thoreau had mystical experiences involving nature really prior to their reading of this literature. So they both talk about how they read their experience back into this. They recognized something that had already happened that was here sort of part of the American experience of walking across the common and feeling, you know, the deep beauty and the huge connection with the universe that Emerson noticed, and Thoreau in the same way, his really looking at the minute particulars, you know, being an investigator of rainstorms and snowstorms, as he put it, and so finding that beauty in the everyday that is so much of, I think, what contemplation is all about.
Now, was there a time later on in history where society shunned this Eastern thought and it kind of went into
it's kind of a hide and seek as you look across the years. So you see interest rising and falling. So there's this big interest in the 1840s, 50s, 60s coming up. It comes up again in the 1890s, a huge flowering, and this is the first time actually that Buddhism comes into the picture in a large way rather than the, sort of the Hindu scriptures and the Sufi works. So 1893 is the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago. Masters from all over the world in various religions come for a visit. A Japanese Zen master comes. A Theravadan Buddhist master comes. People are entranced by this whole idea. The first really, sort of, there's a wonderful story. The first conversion to Buddhism on American soil happens in Chicago in 1893. Anagarika Dharmapala is giving a talk at the Parliament, and a man walks from the back of the auditorium down to the front of the auditorium and asks to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha with this master. So it's kind of this wonderful mix of an image of the sort of the evangelical tent meeting kind of, you know, let me change my life, let me convert, and Buddhism. So, you know, really, really kind of sweet and meaningful there. And the two masters Dharmapala and Soyen Shaku, who was the Zen master, stayed for quite some time in the U.S. and toured and lectured and drummed up interest, shall we say.
No, I'm sure there was a, I'm a martial artist, and I'm sure there was probably movements within the martial artist community for meditation and mindfulness, too, that probably, I know it's not part of your book, but I wonder if you can comment on it, because it's just a personal interest in myself, because I don't know if it...
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Important part of the martial arts was
to
be mindfulness, and certainly.
I think one of the things that Mark mentioned of the Chinese in particular coming to this country, I think that's probably where you would see that infused, because there's not so much literature with martial arts as there were the practitioners.
Right.
So, you know, I think we're talking the same kinds of time periods, you know. So we're talking in the 19th century. Maybe Mark has some perspective on that.
Well, I think what you're pointing out generally is kind of the two branches, if you will, as we look at all of these Asian techniques, whether it's yoga or the different forms of meditation. You know, there's the more physical aspect of it that emphasizes, you know, fitness and movement and postures and breathing. And then there's the more, let's just say, a mental side, and not wanting to make a barrier at all between the mind and the body, because one of the whole points about these approaches is they work with the unity of mind and body. But, you know, you can sort of get there by emphasizing the physical aspects, mm-hmm. which then, you know, put the mind in a certain connection with the body, or you can start in the conscious aspects of our thinking, and then that in turn has effects over the body, and you can enter through the physical side or the mental side.
There's a type of yoga that's just basically, I forgot what they call it in the ancient Sanskrit, but it's basically just service.
Exactly. Dharma yoga.
Yeah, Dharma yoga.
And there are actually like six types of yoga. And the one that we know the best in the West is the Hatha yoga, which is the one that emphasizes the physical postures and movements and breathing. The other five forms of yoga are really all about other approaches, devotional, vocational, you know, they all look at other ways other than the physical aspects of basically getting into that state of consciousness. And so there's many routes to get to the state of enlightenment, basically, which is what yoga is about.
How did mindfulness sprout in? Well, go through what happened a little later on in history, and how did it kind of take?
Let's catch up, because mindfulness itself, that term, really doesn't come into play at all until 1990.
Right.
We got a ways to go yet.
Dr. Zinn, yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
So we're in the 1890s. So, you know, here's a really interesting social factor coming in. So 1893, we have this sort of beginning of a flowering of Buddhism and interest in the meditative arts in America. 1893 is also the start of the Depression of 1893, which went on for more than 10 years before it resolved in the economy. Terrible, terrible depression, you know, very much like what we're involved in right now, you know, a very difficult time with lots of unemployment. And it was actually a real estate bubble that caused it to happen. So, you know, you sort of see this is what I'm talking about kind of the cycles that we go through. So for that 10 years from 1893 into the early part of the 20th century, people were really interested in this kind of thing. How can I help myself? How can I calm my mind? How can I be with, you know, the day-to-day that's so troubling for me?
one of the really, really popular books of the time was Edwin Arnold's verse telling. So this is a poetic, long-form poem telling of the story of the Buddha called The Light of Asia. So big bestseller. You know, we in our book, we compare it in terms of sales to something like Huckleberry Finn or Ben-Hur. You know, so really, really a popular idea in America at this time. I'll bring in one more character that figures very large in the book, and that's William James. So William James knew what was happening, was well-read in the Asian literatures, and was well-read in Emerson and Thoreau. Emerson was actually his godfather. So at one point, William James is lecturing on psychology in his Harvard classroom, and this great Theravadan master comes for a visit to Harvard, comes into the lecture. James stands up out of his chair and says, "You must sit here. You are far more fit to lecture about psychology than I am." And so the Buddhist master talks for a while, and they close the class. James walks back up to the front and says, "This is the psychology that people will be teaching 25 years from now." So it took more than 25 years, but it's happening. Really interesting little incident there, and about just around the time of the First World War, sort of this whole area goes underground again. We sort of, have a backlash, and the contemplative arts are not lost, but suppressed in a way. And they come back again in the modernists. So we see all of this arising again in the 20s and 30s in the poetry, the painting, the music. And so, again, we're talking into the 30s here. We're talking, again, another time of turmoil, another time of really deep suffering in American the culture, the social world of America, and this interest arises again.
Now, did the wars put a
stymie
into all this?
Put a kibosh on it again and again. Although there's a huge outcome from the Second World War, and that's kind of where I'm heading. So, the big turning point for mindfulness and the meditative disciplines, I think, is the American occupation of Japan. Uh-huh. When so many of our intellectuals, our physicians, were able to see how things were done in Japan. So here's American psychiatrists being introduced to Japanese psychiatric treatment. So
must have been like another world for them.
It was indeed. So they're encountering Zen in a way that, in an on the ground way that they didn't really get to when, D.T. Suzuki and Soyin Shaku came here for the first time. Tiny taste of it. Here's a whole culture infused with it, and it infused medical practice, particularly in psychiatry. So there's a very sort of virulent form of anxiety disorder that the Japanese sort of defined for themselves.
And the treatment for it, so this is a really, really horrible anxiety disorder. So think about this. The treatment for it is a residential treatment. You come into the hospital, you are put on the floor, on a mat, in a dark room for 8 days. They feed you, and that's it. No one talks to you.
It's like sensory, kind of like the work that was done on sensory deprivation. And
sort of, kind of a sensory deprivation, and you have to be here with your anxiety, and nobody's going to relieve it for you.
You know, I hear the music, which means it's time for a
break.
A break.
Okay.
So grab some herbs and we'll continue to hear about the history and then actually get into what is mindfulness in the second part of the program. Stay with
us. And the medical benefits.
And the medical benefits, of course. Stay with us, folks, right here, Progressive Radio Network.
Okay.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're with Don McCone, an assistant professor of integrated health at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. And also, we are with Dr. Mike Mikozy, and he's adjunct professor of physiology and biophysics at Georgetown University School of Medicine and founding director of Policy Institute for Integrative Medicine in Washington, D.C., author of Fundamentals of Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and also co-author of Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion. And we're talking about their book, New World Mindfulness, From the Founding Fathers Emerson and Thoreau to Your Personal Practice. So in the first half of the program, we're kind of giving things a historical perspective of that this is not really new stuff. It's really old stuff that's been reinvented, and rediscovered, I think would be a better word.
Yeah.
And then put into practice, even though most Americans kind of feel that it's pretty new and really, particularly its influence in medicine, maybe its influence in spirituality and religious thinking and whatnot is ancient, but how it kind of segues into health and wellness is kind of where I want to end up going soon in the
we're heading right
okay.
there.
So why don't you pick it up where we left off before the break.
Okay. Uh-huh. So where we left off was in the occupation of Japan and American psychiatrists seeing firsthand a treatment called Morita therapy for anxiety disorder, which involves having the person turn and face their symptoms and be with their anxiety. Now, this is a mind blower. I mean, American psychiatry says, you know what? You got a symptom? Let's get rid of it. Let's obliterate it in some way. And the Japanese approach is, no, let's be with it. Let's tend to it. Let's see if we can make friends with it. And so the outcome of this treatment where you're in a room for 8 days by yourself, is they gradually bring you out into the community of the hospital, and you begin to socially interact and still, you know, in touch with your anxiety. And the way they decide, you know, if you're ready to leave, is you wake up one morning and you come down to breakfast and you say to somebody, did anybody feed the chickens yet? Because, you know, the chickens need to be fed. So when the person is not cured, not anxiety-free, but capable of thinking beyond themselves and caring about the world beyond themselves is when they feel that the cure has happened and that the person's life is ready to be lived out in the world again. So the really amazing part of this story, and this will link up again too, is that the cure rate of Morita therapy for this anxiety disorder is more than 90%. You don't have anything like that.
I'm not surprised.
yeah.
Some of the work and readings that I've done with Dr. Rod Borey, who's a well-known psychologist that studied the rest, the restricted environmental stimulation.
Right. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So here we have an object lesson, you know, turning to face your symptoms, being with how it really is in the world. And so that idea went back to America. And really what you see in the 1950s is a sea change in how we treat sort of mental illness, so to speak. So we have the development of the humanistic therapies. You know, we have Gestalt therapy coming up. We have a change in the way people looked at psychodynamic psychotherapy. Eric Fromm was hugely influenced by Zen. Gestalt therapy wouldn't exist without Zen and Zen training. So, you know, this is sort of one of the ways that mindfulness came in. Now, they didn't call it mindfulness. They talked about it as Zen. They talked about it as meditation. And so that was pretty much, you know, what was beginning to happen in the 50s. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, we sort of have a different flowering. So we had the Zen come in, the Japanese sort of austere, kind of intellectual look at things. In the 50s, or at the end of the 50s and moving into the 60s, we have Tibetans arriving, and we have masters from India arriving. So we have a whole sort of different look in things. And so you think about the 60s and the bright colors and, you know, the sort of vibrancy and the ecstatic nature of the music and the society of that time. And so you have interest in the Tibetan forms of meditation, and you have a really big interest in mantra-based meditations. So we have the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi making his appearance in Western culture, and you know,
and
with the Beatles sitting at his feet.
Right?
Pardon me?
The beginnings of TM.
Right. So
one of the things I want to emphasize about the Maharishi is that he consciously kind of adapted the Ayurvedic approaches and kind of took out some of the practices, whether it was in yoga or Ayurvedic medical practice, that would be unpalatable, you know, to the Western sensibility. So there are some very potent and effective things that are done in traditional yoga and Ayurveda that were simply taken out. And so one of the questions that, you know, as a physician and a researcher is, you know, this Western form that we have, is it less potent? Because they took out some of the traditional practices because they thought it would not be acceptable to the West.
What's an example of one of those things?
Vomiting
therapy?
That's a good example, right?
Yeah.
Purging and right. Of course, the evacuation of the bowels, the Basti,
right.
is often included in the U.S., but it's often excluded.
Yeah.
People don't like, you know, the enema. Also, in yoga practice, I mean, there are these practices where you sort of open up the channels by running strings, you know, through the nostril and out the mouth, and
right.
There's all kinds of fairly tortuous practices, but they're nonetheless very potent. And whether we're looking at, you know, medicine from India or medicine from China, we actually, when we research it, find that the practices in the West are, you might say, diluted or adapted.
Well, they were embraced by the naturopathic movement, so which, of course, I'm part of.
Right. Naturopathy is a very good example. We were talking about the 1890s, and in the U.S. back then, you had a lot of choices of different approaches.
Exactly.
You know, herbs, hydrotherapy, homeopathy, natural approaches of all kinds. And actually, naturopathic medicine came along as kind of an eclectic practice which drew from all of the different approaches, and then added in Ayurveda and Chinese medicine at the six major naturopathic medical colleges. to basically introduce the students to all the effective practices. So the idea is to match the therapy to the patient and not to just say, hey, you know, this is what I do and I'm good at it, therefore everyone's going to get it. And that's another major issue in terms of adapting these practices is we actually just published another book called Your Emotional Type with the same publisher, which actually shows that not everybody responds.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know,
and have you on talk about that because that's part of treating the patient and not the disease.
Exactly. Everyone's an individual, and of course, the mantra in all of naturopathic medicine and all of complementary medicine is everyone's an individual. Well, what that means and what we know is not everybody responds well to a given therapy, but with the exception of hypnosis, where we sort of understand how to match someone who's going to be susceptible and someone who's not going to be susceptible to hypnosis, we've been completely in the dark when it comes to all of our other modalities. You know, how do we match it to the person? Now, intuitively, of course, you find out as you engage in treatment. But we learned that by looking at a psychometric measure called the personality boundary type, which is a little bit like the Myers-Briggs, which everybody uses in management in terms of what is your style, if you will. And we found that these psychometric things actually predict who's going to respond better to a given therapy for a given problem.
Now, let's get involved because we're getting short in time. Let's get involved actually in mindfulness. And I know one of the ways to bring people into the present moment, which is very important in this, is the breath. The breath is really our portable stress management system that's free. It just takes education. And
you got it.
People need to know more about it. So tell us about how the breath kind of plays into the whole system here.
Okay. So really what we're proposing is that there are really just three things that three sort of umbrella terms that we can use to bring ourselves into the present moment through the gateway of the body. I mean, if we're paying attention to our body, we're present. You know, we spend so much time in the future and in the past, which is not an embodied place. So bringing ourselves here through the sensations of the body, however they may be, is sort of central to mindfulness practice. And the breath is, as you say, sort of the key. The first piece, though, that I think we overlook is the fact that we are creatures living on a planet, and that planet has gravity. And we are actually being held here. So there's something, to me really quite beautiful in our escape. You know, we stand up, we jump, we move, we walk. So we're negotiating with gravity all the time. We're being held and we're moving against it. And so to pay attention to that can really be something. If you or your listeners just tune into the fact that you're being held in your chair, in your car seat right now, and that you can actually allow that to happen. You don't have to carry as much tension in your body as maybe you are carrying because you're being held here. You know. So I really sort of work with that in my clinical work to help people come into the present moment.
Have you had patients who say, I'm just so wound up and nervous. I can't meditate. I can't still my mind.
Absolutely.
My mind's like a drunken monkey.
And that's really where this book comes from. It's like, I can't sit for 25 minutes or 45 minutes and meditate. Yeah. But, so the question is, can you sit for 2 minutes and allow the earth to hold you? Can you sit for 2 minutes and pay attention to the breath that's happening anyway? So these are kinds of the questions.
Right.
that we can ask ourselves from moment to moment to moment. Can I feel my feet on the floor? Can I really be here? Can I be in this chair? Can I be in this car seat? Can I have my arm on this desk and feel that I can give the weight of my arm to my desk?
Now, what does that do for patients?
Well, so let's...
Maybe physiologically or biochemically or what's going on with that whole process of taking the focus off of the future, which doesn't exist, like you pointed out, or the
right.
past, which is already done. And
which is a story, yeah.
Now, the eternal now.
Yeah. So we're in this place of now. One of the things that the sort of playing with gravity, this gravity practice does, is it really does release the bodily tension that we're carrying from moment to moment. We're holding ourselves up, you know. We're holding ourselves up when we're sitting down. It's kind of crazy. You know, if radio would support it, or if you know, the sort of the verbal thing would support it, we could just settle in for a moment and allow the feeling of the weight of your legs bearing down on the soles of your feet. If you're sitting, the chair or stool or car seat that's holding you. You know, can you just be in touch with that? And so when we're in touch with the body, the mind often calms itself. So it's really not that we can calm the mind. It's that the mind comes to quiet, you know, when the bodily processes calm a bit. So this is the thing with the breath. So let me segue into the breath here. Is that the breath is this the one way into the autonomic nervous system, which is where our stress response lies. So how can we reverse that stress response? One of the keys is that, so what's your breathing like when you're feeling stressed?
You're kind of panting and very short, shallow breaths, things like that.
Precisely. Short, shallow breathing. And that actually is part of a feedback loop. So when we're short, shallow breathing, we're actually sending a signal to the body, hey, things aren't right. We got a problem here. Let's get some more energy. And so we continue with running the stress response. So one of the quickest things that we can do to help ourselves is to sigh. And we spend actually half a chapter on sighing and what it does and how that works in terms of changing the variability of our breathing. But let's just try this. So if you check into how you're feeling right now, just sort of notice what's going on with you in your mind, in your body, body tension, you know, quality of your thinking. And then breathing in deeply through your nose and then out long through your mouth and making a sighing noise. And so we'll do that twice more. Just breathing in and then breathing out long. And then one more time. Breathing in and breathing out long. And so what we're doing when we're doing this is we're sending the opposite signal to the autonomic nervous system that, hey, everything's cool. We can move into what is called the opposite of fight or flight, rest and repair, or for some people it's rest and digest. Because we actually turn off our digestion when we're under stress. We're not going to run that part because we're going to use the energy to fight or to fly. So just a little practice like that during the day. You know, you stop at a stoplight, right. You feel your body in the seat, you take three deep breaths, let them out and breathe out long, So that long breath out is the opposite of the short breath in that we're doing when we're under stress. Send the other signal. Really change how you are. So that, for me, is a moment of mindfulness, a moment of really living inside your body, really living inside the moment. And perhaps it opens up a little further for you. And that's kind of the third dimension. So we talk about gravity, we talk about the breath, and we talk about your disposition. So how are you disposed in the moment? Are you open to how things are, or are you closed to the way things are? Which takes us right back to William James, whose big question for everyone. He said, this is the question that we ask ourselves every moment of every day, is will I or will I not have it so? Can it be like this?
So how do you...
Is this going to be all right?
Yeah,
this is the mindfulness question.
Yeah, but how do you get patients to kind of break out of this downward spiral to kind of remember this stuff? Because in the beginning of a practice, I guess,
right.
I guess I answered my question, because practice makes perfect. But the point is that, like, when people start this, they need reminders. They need pattern interrupters, because they're kind
they
of...
They do, precisely.
Yeah.
And that's you have put your finger on it. One of the things that I do is I say, okay, let's look at the signals in your life that you can respond to with that tiny practice.
Right.
Okay. So the phone rings. Before you leap for the phone, take a deep breath in, take a longer breath out. I think if you just try that today, or if our listeners try that today, just taking a long, relaxing sigh before answering the phone, I bet the quality of conversation is different. And this is the other part of it, is that there's an enormous amount of positive feedback available. So it's not, okay, I have to train myself to do this. It's, oh, actually, if I do this, things happen. I feel different. I encounter my world in a different way. So I do three relaxing sighs, feel myself in the chair. And my next moment, my disposition maybe is a little different. I'm able to, I hate the word, but I'll use it, I'm able to cope in a different way. You know, so we're being reinforced in the practice as we do it. And I think that's one of the really magical parts of it. And, you know, in clinical mindfulness, when we're asking people to, okay, you're going to meditate now every day for 25 minutes, we're asking for that kind of a commitment, is that what happens is people find the benefit. And once they click into the benefit, they keep going. So the studies show, you know, they've done longitudinal studies. Particularly, there was a very long one done on anxiety and meditation. So meditation, after an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course, people's anxiety drops like by about 50%, sort of on average. So you've got much less anxiety. And what they found was 4 years out, people were still getting that benefit, and they were still doing the practice,
wow,
still keeping in touch. So that's a testament to that self-reinforcement of the practice. You don't want to give it up. You don't want to go back there to where life is, you know, 50% more anxious.
Right. Well, on a high-speed lives.
Yeah.
Thank you for this book, and I hear the music, which means we're out of time, but... Thank you again. This is Dr. Z for The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we've been talking with Donald McCone and Mark McCosey, and they're authors of New World Mindfulness, From the Founding Fathers, Emerson and Thoreau, to Your Personal Practice. Thanks, guys. I learned a lot, not only about history, but also some really interesting tidbits to help my patients. So I appreciate it, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And that does it. Bye-bye, folks, and stay healthy.